riding on this system. For once, Rosenberg did not have a flip retort. He merely nodded, then clambered up the shaky aluminum ladder. Harry gave up on the dead phone, stuffed it into the pocket of his bulky coat, and started up the ladder after him. His back twinged with every step. Travis Broadcasting Systems, Atlanta.
They can't all be down, Tad Travis insisted. Not every last one of them.
Herman Scott pushed his rimless glasses up against the bridge of his nose more firmly. He'd never met Mr. Travis before, except once at an office Christmas party where the corporation's founder, CEO, and self-proclaimed genius was more interested in the younger female staffers than a tech geek with an MIT ring where a wedding band ought to be. Every last one of them, I'm afraid, Scott said softly. Travis glared at him as he paced feverishly between the rows of useless consoles. The great man had come down to the monitoring center, the first appearance he'd ever made below the top floor of the office tower, as far as Scott knew. The wall screens were still dead, the monitors still showing nothing but hissing static. For what it's worth, Scott continued, standing in front of his useless console, every other satellite constellation is down too. Geostar, Intelsat, Galaxy, AMC, all of them.
XM, too? Travis asked. I got money in XM.
XM, too. They've all been wiped out.
Sweet Jesus.
Scott waited for the outburst. Travis was famous for his volcanic temper. The great man stopped his pacing and whirled on Scott.
You get the White House on the line. I want to talk to the president. Pronto.
Scott wondered how he could break the news to his boss that he'd called Washington an hour ago, trying to reach the corporation's office in the Capitol, only to find that all the satellite communications links were down and the landlines were jammed with frantic, urgent calls. Situation Room, the Pentagon. Zuri Coggins closed the phone link on her book-sized mini-computer, which she had plugged into the Pentagon's communications network. Cell phone reception was too spotty for this call. Besides, the landline was more secure. Looking up at the people sitting tensely around the table, she said,
The Oval Office says the President's already on his way to San Francisco. Air Force One took off 20 minutes ago.
Then call it back, General Higgins snapped.
Shaking her head annoyedly, Coggins said,
Only the President himself has that authority.
You've got to get him to turn back, said one of the civilians on the other side of the table.
I'm trying, Coggins said. I have a call into him aboard the plane.
Down near the end of the conference table, Michael Jamil muttered something.
What was that? General Higgins demanded.
Looking suddenly embarrassed, Jamil said,
The president has a sort of macho reputation. Maybe the terrorists, or whoever has those missiles, are counting on him going on to San Francisco despite the risk.
Higgins's thick-jowled face darkened.
How do you know they're going to hit San Francisco?
Jamil shrugged slightly.
It's only an educated guess, General. But San Francisco's the logical target, the place where they can do the most damage to us.
How do we know they're terrorists? Higgins demanded. From what we know about this, they're a faction of the North Korean army.
A faction that wants to plunge the world into nuclear war, Jamil argued.
Fanatics? Asked Higgins's aide.
Muslim jihadists?
The Koreans aren't Muslim.
They're communists, Higgins said firmly. Atheists,
Coggins said.
But the fact is that for whatever reason, they've knocked out just about every unhardened satellite in orbit around the entire world.